His presentation is a condensation of his master's thesis from the University of Texas. Comments will be given by Melvin C. Johnson, who is a writer, and his expertise is Southern mill towns, paper, lumber, and railroad in the United States. His graduate work is at Stephen F. Austin State University in Nacogdoches, Texas. There won't be time for questions, so listen up.
The first half of the 19th century saw the unprecedented rise of independent nations around the world. The fire of independence and anti-colonialism sparked by the American and French revolutions flared across the oceans to the far reaches of the globe. Leaders selected by natural talents rather than by birthright began to wrestle the reins of power from decrepit monarchs and colonial masters. By far the most impressive nation building in the world was in the Americas. Nearly every modern nation in North, Central, and South America gained independence between the years 1811 and 1841. It is little wonder that reports of nation building around the hemisphere inspired the creative minds of leaders in the American Southwest. Both Americans and Mexicans saw opportunities to carve out nations from unsettled territories in Mexico, the United States, or in the lands disputed by the two countries. Several short-lived states and nations emerged in the American Southwest during this era, including the Republic of Fredonia, the Texas Republic, the Republic of the Rio Grande, the California Republic, and the State of Deseret. The legality of each of these would-be nations was questionable, resulting in challenges from both the United States and Mexico. A lesser-known nation was also planned in the American Southwest in 1844. Cryptically referred to as the Kingdom of God, this theocratic state was the result of negotiations between President Sam Houston of the Texas Republic and Joseph Smith, the founder of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The proposed Mormon state would have been located in the territory between the Rio Grande and Nueces River. This land, known as the Nueces Strip, was claimed by both Mexico and the Texas Republic at the time. Had the plan been a success, it would have greatly altered the history, culture, and settlement patterns of the American West and Southwest. Although the plan was eventually abandoned, the events surrounding the formation of this Mormon nation in the Texas-Mexico borderlands are important to a broader understanding of both Texas and Mormon history. These events provide further insight into the adversity and unusual political climate that existed in the American frontier during the mid-19th century. The events show the lengths Houston and Smith were willing to go to achieve the twin goals of security and self-rule for their people. On December 20, 1841, Sam Houston gave his first speech to the Texas Congress during his second term as Texas president. In his speech, he explained the three main challenges to Texas security. The first was the weak Texas economy. Second was warfare with Native Americans on the western border. And third, and perhaps most pressing problem to the young republic, remained its hostile relations with Mexico. Houston vowed to resolve these three issues as quickly as possible. On the very day Houston gave his speech, far to the north of the Texas Republic, Joseph Smith wrote a proclamation to his people about their involvement in state politics. Mob violence and regional warfare had forced his fledgling religion from homes in New York, Ohio, and Missouri. Without a voice in government, he was powerless to protect his own people. In Nauvoo, Illinois, Smith planned to flex the political muscle of his church. Whether or not Houston and Smith realized it at the time, both had the potential to solve each other's problems. Houston needed money for his struggling economy, settlers who would be friendly with the Native Americans on the western frontier, and an army to guard his southern border. Smith was looking for a place where he could govern supremely, a land where he would be free to practice his religion without interference from the outside. He had financial assets, a theology inherently sympathetic towards Native Americans, and above all, a large army. Houston, on the other hand, had millions of acres of land to sell or give away. Unlike territory in the United States, this land was outside the control of enemies of the church. It was a land where a people could theoretically start a nation and live life according to their own will and conscience. In 1841, the time was not yet right, as both Houston and Smith were pursuing other options to solve their problems. The failure of these options over the following years would bring the interest of these men together in a way that no one would have expected. Houston first came to Texas in 1832 at the age of 39. He was a war hero, a former governor of Tennessee, a former ambassador of the Cherokee Nation, and a man looking for a fresh start. Texas provided that in those days. Beginning with Mexico's independence in 1821, American and European citizens began relocating to the Texas frontier. The Mexican government made generous concessions if foreign colonists would embrace Roman Catholicism and swear allegiance to Mexico. For several years, the system seemed to work until Mexico's conservative centralist party began restricting the rights of the country's citizens. Allies of the Federalist form of government, established by the Mexican Constitution of 1824, began fighting back in isolated regional rebellions. Texans largely supported the Federalists, and in 1835, a full-fledged revolution erupted in Texas. From the beginning, Sam Houston positioned himself in the middle of the Texas conflict. His experience in the military and government in Tennessee made him a natural leader. After several bloody battles and many casualties on both sides, Houston's forces captured Mexican President Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna at the Battle of San Jacinto. Under duress, Santa Anna signed the Treaties of Velasco, establishing an independent Republic of Texas. Although creators of an independent republic, most Texans desired annexation by the United States. The northern United States feared, though, that the annexation of Texas would spread slavery throughout the Southwest and tip the political balance of power towards the southern states. As a result, Texas remained an independent nation. With that autonomy came great financial, political, and military responsibility and instability. In the first elections of the Texas Republic, Sam Houston was elected to the office of president. Certainly one of Houston's greatest challenges throughout the Republic period was the disputed southern boundary between Texas and Mexico. At the negotiating table following his capture at San Jacinto, Santa Anna made a secret agreement with Sam Houston, establishing the southern boundary of Texas at the Rio Grande. Once safely back in Mexico, Santa Anna refused to acknowledge the boundary agreement and claimed the traditional Texas border lay at the Nueces River, 150 miles to the north. This created a disputed territory along the southern portion of Texas between the Nueces River and the Rio Grande called the Nueces Strip. Although the inhospitable land of the Nueces Strip was defensible enough, the lack of Anglo settlers in the area made the region a nightmare for Houston. According to the Texas Constitution, a president was only allowed to serve one consecutive term. As a result, Mirabeau Lamar stepped in as president of the Republic in 1837. During Lamar's presidency, the Republic's economy floundered as the government churned out devalued paper money. Lamar's intolerant policy towards the Native Americans provoked the wrath of the Comanche, who made repeated raids into Texas. Finally, his hawkish attitude towards Mexico weakened any chance of a peaceful resolution of the border dispute. Mexican troops crossed the Rio Grande with impunity throughout Lamar's presidency. If not for internal disorder in Mexico, Santa Anna might have launched a full-scale invasion of the Republic as early as 1837. Aware of its precarious situation in 1840, the Texas government supported the formation of the Republic of the Rio Grande to serve as a buffer between Texas and Mexico. The short-lived nation straddled both sides of the Rio Grande and included both citizens of Texas and Mexico who supported the Mexican Constitution of 1824. More important to the Texas Republic, the Republic of the Rio Grande created the illusion of a barrier between the belligerent nations. President Lamar gave parts of the Nueces Strip to the Republic of the Rio Grande and sent troops to help in its defense. Nonetheless, Mexican troops reconquered the territory after several months, leaving the Nueces Strip once again undefended. When Houston took office again in December of 1841, he headed a nation weakened by currency devaluation and war. President Santa Anna perceived the weakened condition of the Republic. As rebellion quieted down at home, he ordered a series of military campaigns to harass Texas. The first of these came just days after Houston took office late in 1841, when Mexican troops recaptured the city of San Antonio. The Mexican army made several other successful incursions into Texas over the next 12 months, which took a heavy toll on Texas morale and depleted resources. In 1843, Mexico and Texas signed a one-year armistice, which led to an uneasy truce along the Rio Grande. Houston quickly realized that he needed to populate his unoccupied lands with friendly colonists in order to defend the territorial claims of Texas. From the framing of the Texas Constitution, there were plans to promote immigration to the Republic. Initially, these plans targeted individuals or even families. Then, in December of 1840, the Franco-Texian Bill reached the floor of the Texas Congress. This bill proposed to grant 3 million acres to a group of 8,000 French colonists and soldiers. The bill was controversial and was narrowly defeated. On February 4, 1841, Congress passed a less radical plan that deeded territory and privileges to a colonizing group known as the Peters Colony. Congress gave further concessions to the colonists with the sole requirement that they settle in the unpopulated lands of the Republic. Just 2 weeks after Houston began his second term as president, he broadened the law to include all potential colonists. The Texas government began an aggressive campaign to attract American, English, and French settlers to the Texas frontier. Houston even offered a large land grant in the disputed Nueces Strip to a group of French colonists. Unfortunately for Houston, the French colonial agents could not recruit the needed settlers. Despite optimistic projections, only a handful of permanent towns were ever settled. The Texas Congress eventually revoked most of the colonial charters since the colonial agents could not attract enough immigrants to make the program viable. Apparently, the failure of the Texas colonial movement was one factor encouraging the 1842 military incursions from Mexico. Santa Anna remained confident that Anglo settlers could not create the buffer zone in the South that Houston so desperately needed. So long as Texas remained independent and without military allies, her claims of nationhood would be challenged. It must have been frustrating for Houston to hear reports of Mexican soldiers marching unopposed through the Nueces Strip. Had only the French colonists settled that land, perhaps they would have provided some line of defense. As the deadline for Houston's 1843-1844 truce with Mexico neared, the annexation to the United States still an elusive dream, Houston began to entertain more radical options. The time was right for any group of colonists willing to bring a large population of settlers to Texas to make their move. In this environment, the Mormons, with their assets in the United States, their tolerant attitude towards the Native Americans, and their own means of defense, made overtures to the Republic of Texas. By 1844, they had a church membership reported to be as high as 20,000 people, valuable property holdings in Illinois, and perhaps most important, a professionally trained militia of over 5,000 men. Mormon well-being was threatened in Nauvoo, and newspapers in surrounding towns were calling for their forced expulsion from the state. After 5 years of struggle and building a great city from the swamps of the Mississippi River, mob rule once again threatened the Saints. Joseph Smith was not one to sit back and watch mobs destroy his life's masterwork. He quickly came up with several plans for the protection of his religion, his people, and his way of life. Three of Smith's most ambitious plans directly involved the Republic of Texas. These plans were, first, to run for president of the United States on a platform that included, amongst other things, Texas annexation. Second, to raise an army to patrol the Texas and Oregon frontiers. And third, to move the main body of the church from Illinois to the Texas-Mexico border and establish an independent nation. There are several reasons why Joseph Smith might look to Texas for a solution to his problems. The first reason deals with the unique opportunities available in the Republic at that time. Second, Texas would obviously provide a familiar Anglo-American culture, yet be free of the laws of the United States that had worked to the detriment of the church. Third, Mormons seemed to have a general interest in what was happening in the Texas Republic. During the 1840s, the people of Nauvoo were well aware of situations in the Texas Republic. Joseph Smith had sent a church elder to Texas as early as 1843. In addition, both the Mormon secular and religious newspapers carried articles describing many aspects of the young republic. The sheer number of articles in their small papers shows that there was a great interest in what was going on in Texas. The first secular paper of Nauvoo, The Wasp, which ran from April of 1842 to April of 1843, put out 51 issues. During its one-year run, it printed at least 18 articles devoted to happenings in Texas, an average of more than one article every 3 weeks. In the spring of 1843, the Nauvoo Neighbor replaced The Wasp as Nauvoo's secular newspaper. Interest in Texas continued to grow, as reflected in this newspaper's content. In its first 15 months of circulation, the Nauvoo Neighbor ran at least 36 Texas-related articles at an average of an article every 2 weeks. Given the theocratic nature of Nauvoo, one might initially suspect that Joseph Smith may have manipulated the city's papers to forward his own agenda. Therefore, the increase in Texas articles might be seen as an attempt to garner interest in his Texas plans. A closer look at chronology, however, reveals just the opposite. Smith's Texas plans seem to be influenced by the articles he himself was reading from Nauvoo papers or directly from Texas and Eastern newspapers that came up the Mississippi River. So rather than influencing the news, it seems that newspapers were actually influencing Smith in his own plans. Of Joseph Smith's three plans involving the Texas Republic, the most ambitious was to run for president of the United States. Smith's only realistic chance of winning the election was to split the Electoral College three ways and hope for a presidential appointment from the House of Representatives. Smith clearly believed this was a possibility and organized his missionary force not only to make converts, but also to educate Americans on the issues he represented. One of the biggest issues was Texas annexation. During a March 7, 1844 campaign speech, Smith defined his views regarding Texas annexation. he first made it clear that he was for the annexation of the Texas Republic to the United States. An abolitionist, Smith proposed, quote, "As soon as Texas was annexed, I would liberate the slaves in two or three states, indemnifying their owners, and send the Negroes to Texas, and from Texas to Mexico, where all colors are alike," end quote. This view was not his original thinking. Rather, he was echoing the views of leading abolitionists of his time. Smith then warned against the dangers of allowing Great Britain a foothold in Texas. Quote, "The first thing they would do if they got possession would be to set the Negroes and the Indians to fight, and they would use us up. It would be more honorable for us to receive Texas and set the Negroes free and use the Negroes and the Indians against our foes." The idea of raising an army seems to have evolved in his mind during the following weeks. On March 26, he approved a memorial to Congress that read in part, quote, "Whereas many of the citizens of these United States have migrated and are migrating to Texas, Oregon, and other lands contiguous to this nation, and whereas Texas has declared herself free and independent without the necessary power to protect her rights and liberties, be it ordained that Joseph Smith is hereby authorized and empowered to raise a company of 100,000 armed volunteers in the United States and territories." That weekend, he signed the memorial and sent it to Washington, D.C. with his ambassador to the United States, Orson Hyde. Smith's third and one of his more radical plans as well dealt with the Texas Republic. Unlike his other two schemes, this plan was kept in strictest secrecy amongst the top leadership of the church and was to be enacted only if Smith's presidential campaign failed. Smith proposed the relocation of the church to the Texas Republic to organize an autonomous government run by the Mormons themselves. Considering the recent emergence of nations during this time, especially the attempt at the Republic of the Rio Grande in 1840, it seemed that anything was possible in the Texas-Mexico borderlands. Smith's interest in moving to Texas was part of a greater plan that also included the possibility of moving to Oregon or Upper California. Smith may have first considered the move to Texas in February of 1844. At this time, he organized an expedition to search the disputed Oregon Territory and Mexican lands in Upper California for potential places of settlement. He was not yet ready to abandon his work in Nauvoo, but was looking for safer places where he could send converts. Optimistic news from Texas buoyed the Mormon spirit. The Nauvoo Neighbor printed articles about how the Republic was beginning to thrive agriculturally with every kind of produce cheap and abundant, end quote. According to a reprint from an article in the Texas Telegraph, recently discovered Indian ruins were clearly the castles or temples of earlier inhabitants of the land. The accompanying Mormon editorial claimed this to be evidence of the validity of the Book of Mormon. This no doubt thrilled Joseph Smith to find what he considered proof of his work so close to home. Of a more practical nature, Smith must have been intrigued by the Nauvoo Neighbor's first reports of Texan colonies established with the cooperation of the Republic. On February 7, 1844, the newspaper ran a front-page article compiled from two Texas papers reporting on favorable conditions to be found in Texas. Commerce was flourishing and immigrants were thriving. On February 15, 1844, one of Smith's senior apostles, Lyman White, wrote a letter from Wisconsin where he was milling lumber for the construction of the Nauvoo Temple. He was having trouble purchasing lumber from the local Menomani Indians because of an uncooperative federal agent. Members of the tribe had suggested that the Mormons help them move to Texas where they would be free of federal control. This began White thinking about a similar plans for the Saints. Quote, "We have in our minds to go to the tablelands of Texas, to a point we might find the most eligible, there locate, and let it be a place of gathering for all the South," end quote. White followed up that correspondence with a letter addressed to Smith that same day. Quote, "The committee is well informed of the Cherokee and Choctaw nations that live between the state of Arkansas and the Colorado River of the Texans, owning large plantations and thousands of slaves, and they are very desirous to have an interview with the elders of this church upon the principles of the Book of Mormon," end quote. White reasoned that the prophet, devoted to proselytizing the Native Americans, would view this as a choice opportunity. In addition, he pointed out that Texas could be a gathering place for the thousands of slaveholding Southern converts he expected would join the church. According to Smith's journal, he received the letters on March 10, 1844. Intrigued by White's suggestion, he decided to convene a council to discuss the Texas proposal. This would be the first meeting of a highly secretive group called the Council of 50. Regarding the Council of 50 1950s plans for Texas, Smith's journal reads, quote, letter was read from Lyman White and others dated February 15, 1844, to B. Young, W. Richards, etc., about removing to the tablelands of Texas, etc., etc. Joseph asked, can this council keep what I say, not make it public? All held up their hands. Send 25 men by the Pinery through Santa Fe, and if Houston will embrace the gospel, can amend that constitution and make it the voice of Jehovah and shame the U.S., end quote. The Council of 50 planned to dispatch a party from Lyman White's Pinery to meet with Houston, teach him the Mormon gospel, and discuss the possibility of purchasing lands to settle a group of the saints. The details of this meeting were left intentionally vague. The Council of 50 remains to this day somewhat of a mystery to Mormon scholars and Western historians. All official minutes kept by this group, except for one meeting in 1880, were either destroyed or kept locked in the vault in Salt Lake City, the notorious First Presidency vault that we'd all like to peek into. What is known about the Council of 50 is that their meetings were part of a plan to establish a literal political kingdom of God in the United States. From the Mormon perspective, the kingdom of God was the temporal government that the Mormons established to rule over themselves and eventually, in their view, the world. Exploring the possibility of establishing the kingdom of God in Texas was the first order of business of the Council of 50. Although the official record of this initial meeting is unavailable, one key player in the council later wrote detailed memoirs of the activities of the group. His name was George Miller. Miller wrote that the primary goal of the church was to get Joseph Smith elected as president of the United States. If that failed, the Council of 50, quote, would then send a minister to the then Republic of Texas to make a treaty with the Cabinet of Texas for all that country north of a west line from the falls of the Colorado River to the Nueces, thence down the same to the Gulf of Mexico, and along the same to the Rio Grande, and up the same to the United States territory, and get them to acknowledge us as a nation. And on the part of the church, we would help them defend themselves against Mexico, standing as a go-between the belligerent powers. Lucian Woodworth was chosen minister to Texas, and I was to return to the Pineries to bring down Lyman White. So there you... Yeah, you get an idea of the size that we're talking about. Most of that land in there was in dispute with Mexico at the time, point out. While the Mormon ambassador, Lucian Woodworth, prepared to leave for Texas, Nauvoo received a number of conflicting reports about the state of affairs in the Republic. An overly optimistic article reprinted from the Houston Telegraph claimed that annexation to the United States was a foregone conclusion. It is not known the impact this news had on Mormon plans for negotiations with the Texas Republic. While this would have supported Smith's presidential agenda, it would also prevent plans for establishing an independent nation in the Texas frontier. Smith could perhaps attempt negotiations with the United States government, but his earlier experiences in Washington, D.C. left him cynical about that option. Although the annexation of Texas may have seemed certain to the Houston Telegraph, events in the East were bringing the negotiations to a halt. On February 28th, the United States Secretary of State, Abel Upshur, was killed in an artillery explosion above the USS Princeton. Secretary Upshur had favored annexation, and this upheaval in the government stalled the process for several more months. The Council of 50 saw this as a divine act. Brigham Young exclaimed, quote, the Lord is cutting off the bitterest branches. Look at the explosion of the big gun on board the Princeton war steamer at Washington. God will deliver his faithful saints. End quote. In further support of the Texas Kingdom of God, another newspaper from Texas reached Smith claiming that the annexation report from the prior edition of the Houston Telegraph was a hoax. With hopes lifted, the Mormon ambassador Lucian Woodworth left Nauvoo for Austin on March 14, 1844. A few days later, the front page of the Nauvoo Neighbor declared to the people of Nauvoo that the annexation article was indeed a fraud. The article claimed that Texans were not ready to give up their autonomy until they had tried further negotiations with Mexico for peace. With characteristic optimism, the Council of 50 must have believed that the powers of heaven were conspiring to their support. During this time, Orson Hyde, the Mormon ambassador to the United States, continued to promote Smith's presidential run and his volunteer army of the West. Communication remained slow on the frontier, and Smith pressed on with what little information he could glean from letters from his ambassadors and newspapers coming up the Mississippi River. Allowing for travel time, it is likely that Lucian Woodworth would have begun negotiations sometime in early April, while Ambassador Woodworth met, While Ambassador Woodworth met with Houston, Texas annexation dominated the news in Nauvoo. Four stories on Texas annexation appeared in the Nauvoo Neighbor on April 10th. By comparison, the semi-annual conference of the church received only one paragraph of coverage. Obviously, these negotiations were handled in strictest secrecy. Had Santa Ana known what the Mormons were proposing, he may have sent troops across the Rio Grande to stop any further occupation of the land. One can only guess Houston's reaction to meeting an emissary from one of the United States' most maligned religions offering to purchase three-fourths of his republic. It would serve Houston well not to let other Texans know that he was entertaining such a guest. These were desperate times, however, in Texas, and Houston was not above secret negotiations. The exact timing for the Mormon proposal was perhaps a little awkward. During the second week of April, a Texas delegation proposed to sign a preliminary treaty of annexation with the United States. Although the treaty negotiations gave some glimmer of hope for annexation, it did little to guarantee the independence of the republic if the United States Congress persisted in rejecting it. Houston feared that this constant vacillating would weaken Texas in dealing with England, France, and Mexico. On April 14th, Houston wrote his Secretary of State, Anson Jones, quote, "If annexation is not effected in the present session of Congress, call upon the English and French ministers and ascertain the prospect of all those governments giving us a guarantee against further molestation from Mexico and an indefinite truce. We cannot be trifled within our present crisis, within the present crisis of our affairs," end quote. Texas, it seemed, was willing to deal with whoever could help her in her present crisis. George Miller recorded the events surrounding Woodworth's report to the Council of 50 following his return home on May 2, 1844. As a member of the Council of 50, Miller witnessed this important meeting in Nauvoo and wrote about it in his memoirs. Quote, "The council convened to hear his report. It was altogether as we could wish it. On the part of the church, there was commissioners appointed to meet the Texas Congress to sanction or ratify the said treaty, partly entered into by our minister and the Texas cabinet," end quote. Without revealing the exact details of the agreement, Miller made it clear that Houston and Woodworth reached a preliminary understanding about the purchase of certain Texas lands. But what territory did the Mormons expect to get from Texas? As previously mentioned, the territory the Mormons initially asked for amounted to approximately three-quarters of the republic. Granted, this territory was at that time was among the least valuable lands in Texas, but it seems highly unlikely that Houston would consent to giving up a concession that large. In light of Texas historical documents, it is clearly not a possibility. As early as May 6, 1844, Houston began drawing up plans for a greater Texas, which would stretch to the Pacific Ocean. The Mormons' plan for the Kingdom of God in the western and northern reaches of the Republic would interfere with Houston's vision. Obviously, Houston would have rejected Woodworth's initial offer to buy the greater part of the Republic. Still, Houston must have been tempted by the idea of using the Nauvoo Legion to defend his weak southern border at no expense to his government. It seems likely, then, that Houston made a counteroffer. While existing documents do not definitively say which lands they discussed, clues exist as to what settlements were agreed upon. Key to this is an entry in the documentary history of the church dated April 2, 1847. The entry reads, quote, "Bishop George Miller gave his views about the church removing to Texas, to the country lying between the Nueces and the Rio Grande Rivers," end quote. A letter that George Miller wrote to Brigham Young a month earlier also supports this. He discussed settling, quote, "on the Comanche lands on the eastern side of the Cordilleras Mountains," which are the southern Rockies, "so far south that we could grow cotton and even sugar cane. We could get seacoast on the Gulf of Mexico, where we could land immigrants from the states of England, France, Germany, Norway, etc., in our own ports," end quote. These descriptions, although given some time after the negotiations, show that the land Houston considered selling to the Mormons was the disputed Nueces Strip between Texas and Mexico. By allowing the Mormons to establish their Kingdom of God in this region, Houston would lose territory, but in turn create a buffer nation between Texas and Mexico. The southern isolated location of the Nueces Strip would also not interfere with his establishment of a greater Texas. This mirrored the same logic that prompted Texas to allow for the establishment of the Republic of the Rio Grande in 1840 and the potential settlement of French colonists on some of the same lands just a few years earlier. Why don't we go ahead and change the overhead back to the Nuestra strip, just to have that in mind. Okay, so that's what we're talking about now, a little more manageable tract of land. With his counteroffer accepted by Woodworth, it is much easier to understand why Houston agreed to deal with the Mormons. In order for Santa Ana to send an invading force from Matamoros or Laredo or any of his favorite crossing points in southern Texas, he would now have to contend with the 5,000 soldiers of the Nauvoo Legion. The stability this could provide the Republic was well worth giving up lands that Texas controlled only on paper. In addition, this increased security on the southern border would give Houston more leverage and allow him more time to negotiate favorable annexation terms with the United States. Miller's account then names the three commissioners chosen to lead the final negotiations with the Texas Congress: Lucien Woodworth, George Miller, and Almon Babbitt, although he's referred to A.W. Brown in the official record. It was Almon Babbitt. The lack of documentation in Texas archives makes it likely that the Texas Congress had no idea that they would be meeting with representatives of the Mormon Church for the purchase of the southernmost lands of the Republic. This fact alone makes it clear that Houston perhaps considered the sale of the Nuestra Strip to the Mormons a contingency plan in the event his negotiations with the United States the following week went awry. With no help from the United States, he could then sell the Nuestra Strip to the Mormons, who would stabilize the region with their population base and army. Houston did not stand alone in dealing in duplicitous politics. Although proceeding with the Texas negotiations in earnest, Joseph Smith also used Texas as a contingency plan. He, after all, was running for President of the United States, while at the same time exploring possibilities of relocating to Oregon or California. If he could not effect change in the United States through the political system, he, quote, could fall back on Texas and be a kingdom notwithstanding, end quote. But like Houston, this treaty did not seem to be his first choice. Assuming that the negotiations proved successful, Smith ordered George Miller and Lyman White to prepare to settle the new Mormon territory. White, an early Mormon convert, was a veteran of the War of 1812, a general in the Nauvoo Legion, and fiercely loyal to Smith. With a strong military background and skills in the milling of timber, he was an obvious choice for a Texas colonizer. White made plans to remove his colony of approximately 150 Mormons from Wisconsin and resettle in Texas. If Smith did indeed win the presidential election, he would work for Texas annexation. That being the case, the Texas purchase might furnish another outpost for Mormon settlement within the United States. Lyman White's people could continue their milling work in Texas and provide work and homes for the expected flow of Mormon European immigrants. If Smith lost the election, the Mormons could begin relocating en masse to the Mormon lands between Mexico and the Texas Republic and establish their political kingdom of God. Smith knew that in order for his kingdom of God to become a player on the world stage, he needed international support and recognition. This was the same reason why Sam Houston sought national recognition from the United States, England, and France. Smith duplicated Houston's strategy and named Mormon ambassadors to these three nations as well. Since France and England had been quick to recognize Texas as an independent nation, it would follow that they might also be persuaded to offer support to the new Mormon nation. While no existing documents mention sending an ambassador to Mexico, an article in an Iowa newspaper of the time makes an interesting charge. Quote, "An express has just arrived here from the city of Mexico, bringing the important intelligence that Joe Smith, the celebrated Mormon prophet of the Latter-day Saints, has concluded a treaty with Santa Ana for the purchase of Texas, for which he agrees to assume $10 million of the Mexican debt to England, and has hypothecated the state of Illinois as collateral security for the faithful redemption of said debt. Commissioners have already been appointed to run the boundary line, etc. General Ampudia and Martin Perfecto de Cos are named on the part of Santa Ana, and Prophet Miller and Tiger Tail on the part of Joe Smith." Tiger Tail, I have assumed, was probably Brigham Young poking fun at the lion name given to him by Phelps. I don't have that right here. I have it in my thesis. The veracity of this article comes immediately into question. Besides there being no known Mormon document addressing this, there has been no discovery of Mexican documents supporting this claim. Such information may be part of the private council of the Council of 50 records, although it seems unlikely. Still, the possibility of Smith sending an ambassador to Mexico cannot yet be ruled out. If the report is accurate, then it would seem that Smith could have been trying to play upon Santa Ana's fears of Texas to win Mexican support for his Mormon theocratic state. Mexicans were not the only ones crossing the border during this time. Texans also wreaked havoc south of the Rio Grande. A Mormon buffer state might prove equally advantageous to Santa Ana. The three Mormon commissioners assigned to meet with the Texas Congress did not immediately leave for the Republic after receiving their assignments. Many reasons may explain why this may have been the case. Although Mormon assets were great in Illinois, they were not yet liquid and could only be used as the basis for a line of credit. Matters in Nauvoo also continued to be very complex that spring. Joseph Smith evaded several attempts by Missouri bounty hunters and lawmen to arrest and extradite him. Perhaps Smith was stalling to allow his other plans to develop. In May, the first of in a series of letters written by Ambassador Hyde arrived from Washington, D.C., addressed to the Prophet. Things did not seem promising in Congress. In the politically charged election climate, no one seemed willing to present Congress the Mormon memorial requesting authorization to raise the army of 100,000 volunteers, and thus the petition never reached the floor of Congress. News about a possible move to Texas or the Pacific was more encouraging. Hyde wrote, quote, "If the saints possess the kingdom, I think they will have to take it, and the sooner it is done, the more easily it is accomplished. Your superior wisdom must determine whether to go to Oregon, to Texas, or to remain within these United States," end quote. After four more days dealing with the President and Congress, Ambassador Hyde wrote a letter that painted a bleaker picture of Smith's plans. Not only was Smith's proposal of a volunteer army dismissed by Congress, but his bid for president was also passed off with a smile. With the volunteer army no longer a possibility and hopes for a presidential victory slim, Hyde addressed the Oregon and Texas plans. In sharp contrast to his glowing accounts of Oregon just 4 days earlier, Hyde wrote, quote, "Oregon is a good way off and a not very good country when you arrive there. I have read something of its history since I left and have also conversed with gentlemen who have been there. The tax upon women and children in removing there would be very severe indeed," end quote. The other problem was the large number of Missourians immigrating to Oregon. William, a well-known Mormon hater from Missouri, was in fact organizing a party immigrating to Oregon that very month. Texas, on the other hand, seemed quite a different story. The stalemate over annexation provided the perfect opportunity to move forward with the final negotiations with Houston and eventually the Texas Congress. Hyde wrote, quote, "As Texas will not be admitted into our union, how would it do for you to write President Houston and ask him what encouragement he would give us if we could commence an immediate immigration there and supply him with 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5,000 soldiers to help fight the battle? And then if Mexico would not acknowledge the independence of Texas, but continue to harass her by small parties, make one tremendous rush upon Mexico and capture and subdue the whole country. This would secure Texas, Mexico, and California. If Mexico should acknowledge the independence of Texas without bloodshed, then we should have a delightful soil and climate and an opportunity of extending our settlement into California. Texas would be a central point for emigration, for the coming in and going out of the elders," end quote. Clearly, Hyde felt that the time was right for an immediate immigration to Texas. Not only would the Mormons occupy the Nueces Strip, but they would put the entire strength of the Nauvoo Legion behind the defense of the border. In a move that ran contrary to the defensive nature of Smith's military strategies, Hyde went so far as to suggest an offensive war against Mexico. Still, he held out for the possibility of peaceful coexistence of the Mormons along the Rio Grande. Not only would this bring economic prosperity to the Mormons, but also open the door for their growing ambitions in Upper California. Hyde did not see all as perfect in Texas, though. He wisely pointed out the problems the Mormons would have in starting their own nation. Quote, "If we were to get Texas, or rather go there under the most favorable circumstances which we have any reason to hope for, there is an army to support and also a navy, an executive and legislative government, ministers and consuls to all nations. Would not this enormous weight of taxation keep out capitalists and sink the infant government?" End quote. By June, fate began forcing Smith's hand in his policy decisions. He had immediate problems to deal with at home that required instant action. Torn by external military threats and and internal dissension, Nauvoo was a city on the brink of disaster. In the midst of this, Smith made some unexplained moves regarding Texas. On June 20, 1844, he began entertaining a Texas land speculator, a southern gentleman named Dr. Southwick, who came upriver from Louisiana. Southwick could not have picked a more complex time to come to Nauvoo. The only thing that is known specifically from existing documents is that Southwick came to sell a large tract of Texas land to the Mormons. He got much more than he expected. Southwick was not the only Texas land speculator trying to win the favor of the Mormons. On June 3, 1844, another speculator named John H. Walton wrote Smith from Galveston. In his letter, he offered to sell a large tract of land in northern Texas between the Red and Trinity Rivers. It is not known how these men knew that Smith was in the market for Texas lands. The greater mystery was why Smith was interested in purchasing lands other than those offered by Houston. Why, too, would Smith entertain offers from private speculators rather than dealing directly with the Texas government? A logical answer is that Smith was now looking at the more desirable northern lands for settlement. Since Houston apparently could not sell lands other than the austere, or would not sell lands other than the austere Nueces Strip, Smith would have to make private purchases in order to get choice northern lands. Although in the north the Mormons could not have their own nation, they could hope for a favorable position as citizens of the Republic. Walton's letter perhaps answers that question. He makes some rather optimistic statements about Smith's potential within the Republic. Quote, "I need not point out to a mind as ambitious and discerning as yours the advantages which would certainly result to you from settlement in such a tract in this country. Should you remove here with all your adherents, you would at once acquire the controlling vote of Texas and might yourself aspire to and obtain any office in the Republic." End quote. With more than 15,000 followers, Smith could command a large influence in the Republic. Certainly, he could dominate regional politics in areas where the Mormons purchased lands. Another answer lies in the location of the potential purchase. The land bordered the Red River, which was the southern boundary of Indian territory. This would put the Mormons near the Cherokee Nation. Just that spring, Lyman White had written Smith about Cherokee interest in learning about Mormonism. The Cherokee were a wealthy people by frontier standards. Certainly, Smith could see spiritual as well as economic advantages to a close association with that tribe. Perhaps most appealing to Smith would have been Walton's promise that, quote, "In Texas you will find no dense population to contend with, no bigots to oppress, no overwhelming power to crush you in your infancy, but a new field open to the enterprising pioneer where every hand would be extended to you in friendship. And when you and your adherents, instead of forming a small third party in an inferior state, would at once assume and retain a commanding influence in a republic doubtless richer in resources than any country of the world." End quote. This was much more in keeping with Smith's agenda. Although he expected his theocracy to spread to the far reaches of the globe, his more immediate goal was to find a place where his people could practice their religion in peace. It is likely that Smith, at the very end, shied away from the responsibility of maintaining and defending such a large nation. Hyde's last letter warned about the unforeseen difficulties in managing an independent nation. Perhaps Hyde's warning made Smith see that his plans extended beyond his abilities. It did not take a prophet to foresee that the ownership of the Nueces Strip was going to be hotly contested by Mexico. Perhaps after careful consideration of all issues involved, Smith backed down from his grand scheme of nation building after all. Maybe he could satisfy himself with a Mormon county within the Texas Republic where he and his people could be left alone. His intentions that last week of June 1844, whatever they may have been, were overshadowed by more tragic events. When Smith ordered the destruction of the Nauvoo Expositor, he gave the state of Illinois the excuse it had been looking for to arrest him. Armed mobs and unruly militia massed outside Nauvoo, waiting for the final confrontation with the Mormon leader. The Texas land speculator, Dr. Southwick, as a non-Mormon, managed to infiltrate the meetings of the mobsters. Endangered the lives of its citizens, Smith crossed the Mississippi River, intending to flee to the west. Rather than placating the mobs, his absence only emboldened their threats against the city. When Smith received word that his flight from the city had only made things worse, he decided to surrender to the governor of Illinois. One of his last acts before surrendering was to send a horse for Dr. Southwick. In the confusion, a Nauvoo legionnaire commandeered the horse for another use, and Southwick remained in Nauvoo. What business Smith proposed to settle with the land speculator can only be guessed. Was he trying to find an escape to Texas? Was he attempting a last-minute deal to purchase Texas lands to resettle the residents of Nauvoo? These questions will probably never be answered because Smith, his brother Hiram, and two apostles, John Taylor and Willard Richards, soon became prisoners of the governor of Illinois. On the afternoon of June 27, 1844, a mixture of militia and armed mobsters stormed the small jail holding Smith and other Mormon leaders. When the smoke cleared, the 38-year-old Mormon prophet lay dead. Religious intolerance had cut short the life of one of the most unusual and dynamic leaders in frontier history. Few in Nauvoo ever anticipated the prophet's death. Apparently, Smith himself did not foresee his own death in time to choose a clear successor. This led to a problem which would shake the foundations of the city for the next 2 years. Who would replace Joseph Smith? On July 11, 1844, Lucian Woodworth wrote a letter to Sam Houston that reflected the state of confusion in Nauvoo. Quote, "The great excitement surround us has been sufficient apology for all seeming neglect. I hope your excellency will favor me with a letter stating anything new which may have occurred, and you shall hear from me again more positively when I get a letter. Recent occurrences have prevented me making the propositions desired. If you still consider the plan practicable, communicate and a reply shall be forthcoming." End quote. No further communication is known to exist between Houston and the Mormons in Nauvoo. By the fall of 1844, the Mormons struggled for their very survival, while Texas concentrated on its annexation treaty with the United States. In the midst of these more pressing issues, the dream of the Mormon Kingdom of God and the Texas Republic faded into the background. In Nauvoo, the power struggle continued. The Quorum of the 12 Apostles under Brigham Young was sustained as the ruling body of the church by a majority vote at a conference in August 1844. As head of the 12 Apostles, it became clear that Young would eventually step forward as the next prophet of the church. Recognizing Young's authority, the commissioners in charge of the Texas negotiations turned to their new leader for guidance. George Miller recalled that they planned to, quote, "get the authorities together and clothe ourselves with the necessary papers and proceed to meet the Texas Congress as before Joseph's death agreed upon. Woodworth and myself waited on Brigham, requested him to convene the authorities with the proper papers, that the proper papers might be made out so that we would be able to complete the unfinished negotiations of the treaty for the territory mentioned in my former letters. And to my utter astonishment, Brigham refused anything to do with the matter, that he had no faith in it, that he would do nothing to raise means for our outfit or our expenses. I was really cast down and dejected." End quote. Rumors abounded in Nauvoo, and several men implicated in Smith's murder had fled to Texas. In the Republic, they could potentially continue to make problems for the Latter-day Saints. In addition, the thought of serving as a military buffer between two warring nations could not have been appealing to the pragmatic Young. Lyman White clearly felt the deepest disappointment about the abandonment of the Texas negotiations. According to White, Smith had privately taken him aside in April of 1844 and personally commissioned him to lead the church's entrance into Texas. With characteristic zeal, White believed that this was God's will for him in spite of what Brigham Young or any so-called successor might say. White eventually settled in Texas, where he and his followers were an important contribution to early Texas history. While I cover that in some detail in my thesis, it has been better documented by other historians, including Mel Johnson here, so I'll leave that for another day. And at this point, I'll turn it over to your comments.
It's my great pleasure to be able to respond to Mike's work. I had the opportunity to do a little bit of suggestion and editing on his thesis. I keep forgetting that we have a recording machine going today. What's the purpose of history? It should be two. One, it should be the narrative, what happened. Secondly, it should be the interpretive, what does it all mean? And what did Joseph Smith think during those frenetic and frantic days in 1844 when it did not take a revelation from God to tell him that it was time to go? It was time to take his people and move to somewhere where they could go ahead and create a Mormon nation, be engaged in Mormon nation building, and create a theocratic state. Now, I'm not going to answer a lot of questions, but I'm going to leave some themes for you to think about. These are the things that Mike has opened with this very new type of historiography and taking a look along these lines. The themes of Mormon and Gentile difficulty, of federal and LDS tension, of the Mormon role in manifest destiny, Mormon nation building in the development of the theocratic state, the role of the council in the Council of 50 in LDS policy making, the Republic of Texas national security issues and the role of Mormons, the expansion of the Central Texas frontier, which Lyman White and his apostate colony made very possible during the 1850s. Lyman White's impact on Central Texas before the Civil War has never been recognized, or his colony for what they truly did there. The clash of nations and ethnicity, Mormon and Mexican, Texan and American, Mormon and Christian and Catholic. The LDS gathering to Zion. Do you know that nearly 1,000 Texans would be gathered during the late 1840s to 1857 and would go to Utah Territory? They settled from Pine Valley and Washington down in the Dixie and Iron Missions all the way to the Cache Valley. Seth Blair was a Texan, was a district attorney here in the territory of Utah, was a great friend of Sam Houston, and was also important in the negotiations of putting an end to the Utah War. He was a Texas convert. John Holly was a Texas convert, as were his brothers and his relatives. And they either rode at or participated or condemned at the Mountain Meadows Massacre. They were key players. Where is the further evidence? Well, there are archives in Texas that have not been looked at UT Arlington, at the Barker Center, at the University of Texas, and at the Texas State Library. And, of course, the vaunted First Presidency's vault, where the Council of 50 Minutes reside, still unavailable to historians. The point is that if we look at Mormon history in terms of what it was in Utah Territory, in Utah State, or in Illinois, and forget about the fact that one out of every seven Americans who went west between 1847 and 1869, which was the conclusion or the linking together of the nation with the railroad, one out of every seven was some kind of Mormon. He was an LDS, he was an RLDS, he was a Brewsterite, he was a Millerite, he was a Lamanite, he was some kind ofite. But most of all, he was a Mormonite. If we really think that we can understand the development of Western America without running down all the leads on our Mormon history, then we're missing a great part of it all. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. We have 2 or 3 minutes. Is there a question that anyone has for our presenters?
Yes, I have a question for Mike. Mm-hmm. You stated that Joseph Smith ordered the destruction of the newspaper Navajo Expository. Now, is that documented, or is that just speculation that he ordered? Well, I've heard explained that the newspaper published only once and was set up from the beginning to be destroyed by its creators as an agent provocateur to excuse to attack the Mormons.
The question was about the destruction of the Nauvoo Expositor and whether it was set up to be destroyed and therefore intensify the conquest.
That's really nothing I looked too into. That provided more of the context and backdrop for what I was more interested in.
Smith.
Identify yourself, Will.
I'm Will Bagley, answering the question, was the destruction of the Nauvoo Expositor a setup? Smith was the mayor of Nauvoo. The council ordered the destruction of the press under his direction. Interestingly, it's unlikely that the publishers themselves were plotting this. And what they proposed publishing in their second edition were details on Smith's political plans, an expose on the kingdom of God. And The polygamy issues had been somewhat vented in the first issue, but where they really hoped to raise Cain was with an expose of the kingdom of God.
The Navajo City Council ordered. That's documented.
Yes, in the minutes.
Yeah. All right. Is there another question?
Yes, sir.
Come up.
Just curiosity, I wanted to carry this a little far. When Lyman White took his group to Texas, did they settle more than just the colonies of Johnson City and Zodiac? And where were those? Were those colonies in one of those tracts that they had negotiated for?
I'm going to pass that right on over to Mel, because that's really his area of special expertise.
They began a 1,300-mile journey lasting almost 2 years from the Wisconsin border down the Mississippi River. They spent their first winter in Grayson County at the old Fort Johnston, 1845 to 1846. Spent the next year down at Austin in Travis County. Spent the following 4 years in Gillespie County, just east of Fredericksburg, where they built the first mechanical milling settlement in West Texas. Moved on down the road to Burnett County, Hamilton Valley, for 2 years, bankrupted. Went down to Bandera County, opened up the first mechanical milling settlement down there. They practiced the United Order. They practiced polygamy. They practiced the Holy Priesthood, and they followed Lyman until Lyman's death in March 2nd of 1858. After that, the Lymanites dispersed. Some stayed in central Texas. The last surviving polygamous male dying in Bandera in 1913. You ought to read their county histories. They list the wives sequentially, not concurrently, for some reason. Others went and joined the Josephites in Iowa, were very influential in the establishment of Lamoni and Graceland College. Others went out to California to get away from the Civil War and were instrumental in the RLDS revival and conversion in Southern California, a very large RLDS community out there. Very few reconverted to Mormonism, Utah Mormonism, and came to the state. And one of them became a convert of the RLDS territorial missions during the 1870s and took his crew back to Iowa. Interesting group.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. If you have other concerns and comments for our participants today, I invite you to buttonhole them out in the call, out in the hall. Thanks again.
I'm just going to just